Peace and blessings. You are listening to Talib's Welcome Home Podcast, a space where we aim to provide content and connect our spiritual hearts with community, love, service, and prophetic wisdom.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. With you is Ali Dia and our co-host Dr. Will Caldwell and Mike Swice. And we have a special guest with us here today, Imam Ahmed Deeb. Alhamdulillah, it's amazing to have him. And we're discussing something that is really intriguing to Ta'lif, and I believe very intriguing and has taken a lot of Ahmed Deeb's time, which is unmasked to remasked. Welcome, all of you.
Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you so much.
Assalamu alaikum.
Ahmed Deeb, good to have you, Habibi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming out. Yeah, you're the first guest in our podcast, right? And it's only befitting because we're discussing something that, you know, it's always lingered in the back of our minds, especially when me and Mike and Will talk, right? There was this movement that started, Dr. Will, you know, maybe like in
around 2014, 2015 timeframe.
Yeah, and it was like this unmasked movement that captured a lot of people's minds and hearts at the time.
Look, when I became Muslim, I took Shahada in 2006. So a lot of what I was looking for was community, right? When I became Muslim, I would go to this mosque or that mosque. And oftentimes I would be felt like, and remember, this was about 20 years ago or so. Yeah. So I'd oftentimes feel like I was looked at sideways, or there was some kind of cultural barrier that I had to rise to in order to feel a sense of acceptance and belonging in those communities, essentially making me feel like, where can this like guy, this white guy from the suburbs named Mike, who's a Muslim, like fit in, right? And I went on my own journey, and that's essentially what got me to the community work that I was involved in. Can't find it, so let's build it ourselves, right? And through these years, that's when I met Ustad Usama, love, mercy on his soul. We combined forces with Ta'lif. And then right around like 2010, 2011, there spurred like this conversation, right, of like unmasked, right? Which I think comes largely from literature and research about like being unchurched.
Unchurched, yeah.
Right? So like that movement kind of went over to the Muslim community, and people started turning over rocks and said, what is the size of our population? How engaged are Muslims in America? And that led to a lot of people who were upset expressing their dismay at the status of leadership in our community, of our places of worship, almost to like a state of like anarchy. Like everyone just, the doors were open and all of the skeletons came out of the closet, until a point where they actually made a movie about it called Unmasked. I actually watched the trailer to review it.
Yeah, I watched the trailer just recently, but I never watched the whole thing. Will, do you watch it?
I haven't seen the whole thing either, but I did watch the trailer. I remember it coming out at the time, and it really like capturing a lot of people's attention, because, you know, before there was a word, unmasked, there was a sentiment that was kind of going around in the community that, you know, what I guess we call third spaces were becoming increasingly important because of this feeling that you express, Mike, that hey, I don't necessarily feel that the mosque is a home to me, right? I go there to pray, but it doesn't feel like where my community is. And so, you know, people started to make their own forms of community outside the masjid. And so that was all going on. And then, you know, I think this word came around, and it really just, it put a label on it that, it put words to a feeling.
Whatever happened to the movement? Is it still around or what?
I have not heard much about it in recent years. And I think there's a reason for that, which we can probably get into. I think probably like the proliferation of third spaces and some genuine changes in a lot of masajid across the country have also like ameliorated some of that discontent that was there.
I have a far more cynical...
Oh, good.
Nice. Bring it.
No, I'm joking.
I won't be the cynical one.
No, I'm not either. I wouldn't be, you know, I didn't devote my life to this if I was like truly cynical. But I think there's a reality beyond what you said, which is once you expose a lot of these issues that, in fact, if you watch the documentary, it's really almost always about governance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like the heart of the problem. It's not just, you know, the random auntie looked at me funny, right? Which we, catastrophize, actually, when we talk about a sense of belonging or not. And we assume, oh, it's just, you know, the rowdy uncle or the rowdy auntie or whatever, which I think is too simplistic of an understanding of what's actually going on and what's leading to such discontentment. Really at the core of it is governance. And I think, I don't really know the leadership of the Unmost like documentary. I watched it when it came out long, long time ago. But the point I wanted to make is that you realize some of these structures are actually built to withstand any changes to their status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a type of, okay, well, we did our best. What else can we really do here? And then I think that actually motivated the proliferation of third spaces. Mm. Because I do believe most of us who grew up around mosque communities, the first instinct wasn't, oh, I had a bad experience. Forget these mosques. Like, that's not our first instinct. The first instinct was, okay, that was interesting. And then you start noticing a pattern, and then you say, hey, can I do something to actually change it? And then after that effort, you know, the unmosquedness happens actually after a bunch of what I believe to be sincere people, you know, and I think that's just the husn al-dhan that we should have of them trying to enact, you know, positive change and then hitting a wall consistently until, okay, you know what, all we can do is, number one, expose some of these issues. So hopefully it raises the collective consciousness. And then number two, let's establish alternative spaces in the meantime because the community needs have to be met.
Yeah, and this is a perfect time to mention, I think some people try to bring Ta'lif into the unmasked conversation at that time. Mm. I remember, Mike, you were really a part of that.
Yeah, like even when they were filming the documentary, there were a lot of like requests to interview people at Ta'lif and things like that. And I think not to speak on behalf of other leaders, but I think the initial reaction of the people up in the food chain in terms of our organization were actually incredibly resistant against it.
Mm.
Because they were like, look, Ta'lif is an intentional community, right? Like we have values and principles and we're trying to build around creating a certain environment to help people grow and empower them.
Right.
This is not like a place where we're trying to rival the mosques.
Ta'lif to us has always been a funnel back to the mosque.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? It's like a way to feel secure enough, comfortable enough in your own identity as a Muslim. So then what Imam Ahmadi was talking about is like if the auntie or the uncle come to you and they correct something or try to say something to you or give you a look that you're not really feeling, it really doesn't change your whole identity at that point. You're cemented in your reality as a Muslim. Right. Absolutely. In who you are. It doesn't shake you to the core like you were saying, right?
Because it can.
It can. And I remember this because my wife, this is amazing. Like last week she mentioned this to me. I had no idea. She out of nowhere just mentioned the story. She had no idea we were doing this podcast. And she said, you know, there was one time I went to this masjid, I forgot where it is, and I was praying. And there was a lady praying next to me. And right when I finished my salah, right when I finished my prayer, the lady looked right at me and said, you weren't looking down during your prayer and you weren't focused where you were supposed to be focused during your prayer. And my
prayer police.
Yeah. And my wife looked right at her and said, oh, the fact that you were paying attention to where my eyes were in salah means that you weren't looking down and you were just like, thank you very much, but please keep your advice to yourself. And then she left the masjid. And I was thinking about that. I'm like,
mic drop.
Right? Can you imagine if she was caught at a different time in her path to this tradition,
if her how feet really were not secure enough, right?
Because she was able to just confidently look at this lady, although I believe that lady was very sincere. I do. I believe that lady that came up to her was actually thinking that I'm helping an individual. You see what I'm saying? The piece that's missing here is how and the translation, right? But imagine if it came to my wife way earlier on in her path, what it would have caused for her.
Well, I mean, I think the how is only, you can only answer that when you have a discussion on what the communal culture of the mosque is supposed to be, which then also lends the question, what is Ta'lif funneling into? You get what I'm saying? Like, you can't actually even define the purpose and role of Ta'lif without defining the role of the mosque, right? Because they're all third places. They're all third spaces. The mosque is.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you. That's what we love to say. Like, Dr. Will tells us all the time.
Brother Mike tells you
right? all the time. And Brother Mike. That's right. Well, I mean, we all have that discussion, but Will, please break down, what's the third space for everyone?
So a third space, technically, is any place that people go sort of like between the home and their workspace,
exactly.
Right? The home and the workspace are the first and the second spaces. Meaning, like, that's where we spend the majority of our time. Where we spend, I guess, what you could call our leisure time, and you could put like worship, you know, as generally conceived, like it's something we do outside of our family obligations and our work obligations. You know, the mosque would be a third space. It's somewhere we choose to go to. It's a community that we choose to be a part of that, you know, is neither of those two places.
So first space is home.
Home.
Second space, work.
Work.
Third space, place of worship.
Place of worship, coffee shop.
Any place right? of like connection.
Any,
really.
Yeah, any place. Club. Yeah. Right, exactly. So, I mean, it is correct to say that the mosque is a third space.
Hmm.
Just as Ta'lif is a third space. Like, we are inhabiting, you know, a similar, or fulfilling a similar role.
Yeah, but you know that the majority of Muslim understanding of this is that the mosque is not a third space, and that places like Ta'lif or others that have popped up, those would be considered third spaces in their mind. And that's what we're trying to, like, break down.
That's precisely the issue. We don't have a definition.
Definitions. I want to interject real quick. So definitions, I think, and expectations are the root cause of a lot of these problems, which I hope I noticed this in your survey, which we'll get to in a second. But there was a conference at some mosque nearby in like the Midwest, and some of people who come here were there. And one of the sheikhs decided to give a talk about first spaces, second spaces, and third spaces. Dude rewrote the book on what these words mean. He literally said the first place is a place where Allah is centered and important. The second space is where, you know, Allah, you know, people are kind of, you know, practicing Islam, but not really. And third space, like, everything goes.
Imam Deeb, what do you think about that?
But this is about definitions, right? Like,
cool,
we're making up as we go. When I watched the Unmosque documentary part that I did watch, what did I see? The same thing. These, like, very fluid definitions of what people expect from a mosque. Me, I was telling him, I'm very simple. When I fill out a survey, it's like, all I expect from a mosque is to be able to go pray in a clean, quiet place. That's it, right? Other people want community, and they want schools for their kids and all these lavish expectations, which are great. But if we can't narrow down, right, like what people want and need, we're going to always have these things that keep kind of bubbling up.
Or at the very least, recognize that we have very different expectations about these spaces. And I'm sure it's not just the masajid. Like, I'm pretty sure that people come to Ta'lif with different expectations.
Absolutely.
Right? And so when there's no conversation as to what, you know, what the expectation should be. And that's really the heart of the problem is what people perceive to be the should. It's not what I can find. It's the what should happen here. And because there's a fluidity in definition, add to that such unprecedented diversity in the way that Muslims exist that Islamic history has never seen before.
Yeah,
I think we don't talk about that enough. Like, we are living in an unprecedented time of Muslim diversity in America, right? Like, one of my mentors, he calls America the perpetual hedge because that's what it is, right? One mosque, you have 16 ethnicities, and many of them are still, some of them are immigrants, some of them are first gen, some of them are third culture kids, some of them are mixed, some of them, and then you're trying to figure all of this out without like a intentional communal culture, because the definitions are going to change depending on the place and the needs and what have you.
I would say in Chicago, what it's really like now, because we have so many Muslims, the masajid have been predominantly a certain specific background.
Of course.
Does that make sense? So you got like, you got your Indo-Pak masjid, you got your Syrian masjid, you got your Palestinian masjid, you got your Sudani masjid, you got, you know what I'm saying? So it's kind of...
And that's a national dynamic as well. Yeah. I think, you know, this goes back to a point that you made earlier, which is probably good to bring back up. You said it comes down to governance, right? Like there is, when we're talking about third spaces, which Tatlif is one alongside the Masajid, you know, a lot of like what is called third spaces, so spaces outside the masjid, they were probably formed because of these issues of governance. And like a lot of what you see, like the rowdy uncle or the rowdy auntie, like these are downstream effects of governance. I mean, that is very much a result of like who feels a sense of ownership in that space because they consider that to be their space.
Yeah.
Some people do and others don't. I would, like my observation is that this is very much a generational phenomenon. Like in addition to being a cultural one, right? Where you have like ethnicities that predominate in a particular masjid. It's not just an ethnic dynamic. I think it's a generational dynamic as well, where you have like this older generation who probably founded that masjid, right? So they have an extreme sense of ownership over it. And, you know, like what your wife experienced, Ali, like what you have experienced, Mike, what I've also experienced, you know, part of what we have realized about what is going on at Tatlif, which has always centered convert care programming in some way, is that it has appealed to a larger demographic than just converts.
Yeah, basically everybody else, I agree.
But of our generation.
That's right.
Like, you know, that's what's really interesting about it, is it has appealed to Muslims of all different backgrounds, of the millennial generation, and now we're seeing the Gen Z generation come in. I think this is very much a side effect of not having a sense of ownership over the mosque spaces.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I agree. But I also actually think the root cause isn't generational divides, nor is it immigrant versus non-immigrant, because I operated in communities that didn't have that generational problem. I remember I served at a masjid. The majority were born and raised in this country. They were first gen. Some were second gen.
And so tell us some of the findings from your research.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so the thesis, the thrust of the thesis is that at the core of, so I guess let's break down community, you know, from a community psychology perspective, you know, the one of the things they talk about is the idea of sense of community. So my kind of typology in all of this is that there's three primary elements to defining a community. The first is the actual space. The actual physical space tells a lot about what the culture and what the ethos of the community is, right? So having a space is very important. There's much to be said about that. What is the aesthetic? How should it look like? You know, if there's anything we learn about Islamic history, you find that the spaces always mirrored the culture of their land.
You're talking my love language now.
Yeah.
This is
my love language. Yeah, well, the aesthetics are important. And one of the things I personally get really annoyed at is this idea that we turn the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam's simplicity in designing the space into, you know, spaces can be ugly and not have any intentional thought. But that's like, that's very strange. One of the ways this comes up, and I mentioned this in my book, is that, you know, I remember when I was, because, you know, it's not just converts and new Muslims that experienced the negative effects of bad governance, yeah, or bad communal culture. So when I was a teenager, I would try to like do my dhikr after Fajr, you know, my father's mosque. And, you know, I think at the time I was like 15, 16. And usually I wait till everyone leaves so I could turn off the lights because I just don't like fluorescent lighting, right? It bothers me, it's distracting. I like natural light. I'm a Floridian, so there's a lot of that. You know, it seems natural. So, you know, I remember once I turned them off. And, you know, uncle was just like about to leave. And he noticed. And he kind of comes back in. And he says, why'd you turn the lights off? This is what insert group does. And it's bid'ah. And then he turns the lights back on. And, you know, it's a hilarious story because I wish at the time I had the confidence to be like, I'm pretty sure the Prophet ﷺ didn't have fluorescent lights. Like, how is me turning them off a bid'ah? But see, the point I was trying to make is that when you actually look at the Prophet ﷺ's mosque, it was very dimly lit. Mm-hmm. They would, the companions would report, they would barely see each other during Maghrib and Isha. And so there's a tendency to look at that and say, ah, they just, you know, they were too poor to have lanterns or something.
Also,
you know?
There's something real about the prayer times actually following the reality of the environment.
Yeah, of course.
There's exactly. Something that comes out with the salah. Like the few times that I prayed in the desert outside, it's a different prayer.
Yeah.
When you're actually following the natural lighting of the world that's around you. I mean, it changes the whole spirituality of the prayer.
Exactly. But you know, you can, you know, the problem is you can look at that and say, oh, well, if the Prophet ﷺ did have the fluorescent light that we had, he would have implemented them. Mm-hmm. It's like, first of all, what do you know about what the Prophet ﷺ would do? Second of all, like there's an assumption that the Prophet, peace be upon him, didn't have an intentional design in his spaces. If he didn't, he wouldn't have told us not to be extravagant. Mm-hmm. That is an intentionality in space, to tell us that the physical space there's a simplicity that's supposed to engender a type of calm and tranquility when people enter. So that's number one. The second element is sense of community, and we can address it if you guys like in a bit. And the third element is governance. Governance is really what's going to determine whether you are a healthy community or a cult. I mean, that's usually what's going to determine what direction you take, because culture can be built bottom up. It can. But what you find in spaces is that culture is usually dictated top down. And there is a trickle down effect, as you were saying, right? That, you know, why does someone walk into a mosque and feel a particular entitlement to correct this and that person? Where does that come from, right? Now, I'll tell you for a fact, when I was imam, you don't get a lot of that when I was imam. Why? Because part of the intentional culture I was trying to cultivate is don't rush to correct, rush to greet. And then, you know, humble yourself.
That's an example of a top-down.
Exactly. Yeah, that's an example of a top-down.
Which is healthy.
Yeah, I think
not
so.
Not all top-down is, right?
But yeah, of
not,
course.
Also,
of course.
Same vice versa. But just to, like, unpack a little bit, you've, Imam Ahmed Deep, in case folks don't know, you've done a lot of community work. You've also started a few communities and been a part of a few communities, like Shifat community, the Pillars community. Now you're doing your PhD at National Lewis University here in Chicago, right? This is why we're here in this discussion, because one of the main questions that came to my mind when you did the remost, right, attempt, PhD talk that you're going through, inshallah, Allah give you success, is, was this a response to the unmost?
Yeah, that's a great question. The remosked, I just thought it was a really good play on words, to be honest with you. Like, it's not that deep. It's a little deep, but not too deep. I like the word, and I was obviously aware of the unmosked sentiment, not the movement. Like, I don't know how it ended up manifesting. I don't know anything about the unmosked leadership. It's not associated with them, but I resonated with the sentiment, as many of us did. I mean, we'd be lying if we didn't resonate with the fact that, hey, I love a space that I feel disenfranchised from. That's what people are saying. I want the mosque. I love the mosque, but I can't go there because I don't feel I belong. I don't feel this space rises to the needs that I have, which goes back to definition. Should it rise to the very, you know, multifaceted needs of the Muslim community? Or maybe is part of the problem that we're expecting too much from the mosque? That's a different discussion. So I wasn't really responding to the movement, but I wanted to carry forth the sentiment that I didn't want for people, that I didn't want to be lost. And so the idea of re-mosqued is to say, hey, as an imam, as someone who grew up in mosque communities, my father was an imam, his father was an imam, his father was an imam. This is like my whole lineage. I'm here to tell you, I also feel that way. In fact, I felt that way also as an imam. So I want to now say that pain, maybe we can channel it in a constructive way, as opposed to just complaining. Okay, which, by the way, I'm very sympathetic to. Like, people are in pain, and I also am sympathetic to the apathy. I'm sympathetic to the apathy of people being like, look, man, I got too many bad experiences. I'm just trying to raise my kids, and I don't have time for the silly politics that I keep running into. I'm sympathetic to all of that, but it was really a introspection. I didn't want to react to the negative experiences I've had in both as an attendee, as a leader in the community. And re-mosqued was an attempt to say, and to really answer this question, why has no one made this an actual expertise? Because this really was the frustration for me for a long time. Community, the reason why mosques just operate for so many years in the same status quo environment that everyone is saying, or at least a critical mass of people are saying, hey, maybe there needs to be some changes. Why is it operating like that? It's because, let's just be real, for a lot of us, we've allowed community to be like a backyard do-it-yourself project, right? There's no, do we do this in any other field? We have expertise in medicine, right? You can't just write a book on medicine having no training in medicine, right? And say, this is now the authoritative, this is the authoritative representation of, you know, medicine. Of course not. So I wanted to see, is there a way to create a realm of expertise when it comes to community building and community development? And in that research, I found out that in the 60s, a field was basically created in academia specifically for this. In the heart of the civil rights movement comes a bunch of psychologists who say there has to be a more holistic approach to doing the work of psychology. And they come up with community psychology, which is like a mixture of clinical, social work, sociology, all of it kind of mixed together into a science. And in the 70s, someone came up with the concept of sense of community, which is, how do we actually measure something as intangible as people's feelings of community, right? And what does that look like? So, long story short, when I discovered this, I thought, you know what? This is the perfect way to kind of channel some of these ideas and theories with a little bit of a scientific rigor that hopefully the community can respect and say, you know what? Maybe we will consider these theories now.
That's great. We were talking earlier about solutions, and when this whole un-mosque movement started, I remember two of our teachers, they did a program at a mosque nearby here, and their impetus was, let's go and reclaim the mosque.
Yeah.
Right? Let's go and bring this program with these well-known teachers who are celebrated all throughout our community. Let's bring them to the mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And bring all the people to the mosque and talk to them about how the mosque has rights over you, right? And how you belong here and this is your place. And there was someone...
And this was a very much an intentional response,
yes,
to the un-mosque movement that was really gaining steam at the time.
Yeah. And as that program, you know, it was a great program. I still remember this day, like lessons I've taken. It was almost a decade plus ago. But like the irony, right? Of like the whole situation was someone we had all been working with who was interested in becoming Muslim decided to go to that and hadn't outwardly taken Shahada yet, although the heart was on the path towards that.
I remember this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
We worked. I remember
this. We all like ironically were supporting
these
people
that.
In different ways. And as they came to the mosque, they were quite literally stopped at the door and asked if they were Muslim because they didn't return the salams. And they were like, look, if you want to come into the program, you have to take your shahada. And this is someone we've been working with, like, came, this is before we were even Tatlif. This is like Convert Connection days, right? And this person ended up leaving and was like sad and confused and called, I think, your family and reached out to me. And, you know, and this begs a question, right? Are the mosques ready to receive? I love the idea of remosquing. Let's bring people back in. Are they ready to receive? What are things that, you know, I know you have your survey, I don't think is countering that aspect. It's more of like the user experience side.
It's both.
So this is my question. Do we think the mosques are ready to receive people?
Yeah. So the answer is an unsatisfying yes and no. Because
that actually makes sense.
Because some mosques are ready, and some mosques I would not tell people to even go to as their first reference if they're a new Muslim or a non-Muslim, just because I don't know what they're going to be exposed to. Even though, at the end of the day, I do believe there's barakah if these spaces are built with taqwa, and that no matter what, inshallah, like there'll be khair. But at the same time, we do have to make wise decisions. And there's certain spaces that are simply not conducive to people's spiritual health. So are they ready to receive? Some are. But the more kind of theoretical answer is we're never going to be ready to receive if we don't get serious about the philosophy of governance, the philosophy and the theory of what makes these mosques mosques in the American context, because they can take on different definitions. And in fact, throughout Islamic history, they did take on different definitions. That's why you have different terms that were used to describe
a mosque. What I'm hearing you say is that, well, before I say anything, I'm of the opinion that I believe masajid throughout the U.S., mosques throughout the U.S., have overall now, being in this community thing for the past 15 years or so, have done a way better job in general, okay? I'm seeing that in different aspects. Like, they're really trying in different ways.
You're saying the general trend, it seems to be on the upswing.
That's what I feel like.
For sure.
And the other thing that I'm going to say is, though, what I'm hearing you say is that there needs to be experts for this in the masajid for it to really take on the life that it needs to be at.
I think experts in general. Like, obviously, not every masjid is going to have someone who did a PhD in community psychology. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that there has to be some sort of appeal to expertise if we're going to break these walls. Because they're walls. I'll tell you an example. I don't think people maybe who are listening understand what we mean when we say walls. Let's say, so in community psychology, they have three orders of change when it comes to social change and societal change. The first order change, we're all aware of. You know, not a good board member, replace with a good board member. Okay, that's first order change. You take out people, you replace them with better people. Okay, second order change is the idea of changing the system. Okay, changing the system. You might ask, why would we need to change the system? Well, if you start reading some of these constitution and bylaws of these mosques, you're going to be like, yeah, I could definitely tell this was written in the 70s. You know what I mean? And I can also very quickly tell this is probably not going to work at a time like now. And, you know, there's so much ambiguity with terms. Like, you'll find in constitutions, you know, certain board members can be removed for unethical behavior. And when you ask who determines the unethical behavior, it's the board member. What are we appealing to with ethics? Are we appealing to Quran and Sunnah? Yes, but we get to determine what that interpretation is however way we want. So this bully can stay on the board indefinitely. And I'm using that term on purpose, right? The third order change is realizing, because there's certain constitutions, that, just to go back to systemic change, there's certain constitutions that literally make it impossible for you to change. So, for example, some structures of masajid have it so that the board, there's two boards, directors, board of trustees, and some of them are called different things depending on the mosque. Some don't call them boards. That doesn't matter, right? So this board of directors which is basically the execution, the directing board, they could all decide on something. But then the board of trustees can literally just say, nope, we don't like that, and we're going to veto it. Now, this becomes problematic when a board of trustees have indefinite lifelong membership, or some of them have membership until they're in their 70s. How they get chosen, right? No one knows. So then you have some are nominated. In other masajid, you have an election model. And you might think, oh, elections are probably fair, but it just becomes a popularity contest, right? So, you know, I'm going to answer the receive question through this third order of change. When you realize at some point, you cannot even change the system, right? And the first order change is not cutting it, because the good people are coming in, and what do you think happens? They end up getting jaded. Like, they do their best. They're like, I can't be engaged in some of these petty politics. I just want to like put a good program on.
Yeah, that becomes a wall.
And it becomes a wall, right? So in community psych, they talk about the idea of consciousness raising, which I write about, and it's very profound for me, which is at some level, you have to say, all we can do is elevate the discourse, raise consciousness. And part of that is also establishing alternative models. And so when you're saying, I'm seeing an upward kind of swing and a hopeful swing towards this masajid, of course that's going to happen, because a lot of people of our generation realized, hey, we can't keep doing this dance. So let's establish alternative institutions. And hopefully these other masajid, who we're in a capitalist country, and how do most institutions operate as 501c3s? They need donations. So you're now going to have to compete as a result. Yeah. And through that, change is kind of bound to happen. And so when I say expertise, I'm talking about this third order change. Can we raise the consciousness and just get people to realize this can't be a do-it-yourself project anymore? Our community is growing, our needs are growing. And not only that, like the social fabric of America is changing. And so, you know, I know this is controversial, but let's talk about it. We want people to convert to Islam, right? And we're all so excited about these shahadas and to welcome them. Okay, what do you do with the queer Muslim who just became Muslim? How are you going to accommodate them? Do you accommodate them? What is inclusion without exclusion? How are you defining inclusion and exclusion? These are literally questions where kind of we assume we can just ignore out of existence. But they're only becoming more and more pressing with each passing year. And expertise demands, and you guys are from expertise, mashallah, you're working in Tel Aviv, you're helping to cultivate a longstanding organization, an exemplary one, right? We have to start getting serious about these questions and see what frameworks are helpful, what frameworks are not, and how do we paint a philosophy that can work, even if it's not a black and white approach that works everywhere, which you're never going to find.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we've seen exactly what you're talking about, because we've had many masajid reach out to us over the past couple of years saying like, hey, we are receiving this influx of converts.
Yeah.
And frankly, like, we don't know how to accommodate them.
Yeah.
But we see that you guys are doing that, and that you're doing it well, that people come to your community, they feel welcome there. We want to know how it is you do what you do. And
alhamdulillah,
I mean, we've entered into like a new phase, really, where we're like consulting now.
We're consulting.
Yeah.
We're providing services to a lot of places. Like, a lot of the stuff that we've been doing here internally for a number of years, we've sort of opened up to other communities and said like, hey, like, you can send people to us, they'll still be a member of your community. But like, when it comes to specific convert care services, right, we'll take care of them on that level. And I think it's exactly the type of change that you're talking about.
Right.
No, I agree with you. You know what's really interesting is that, I don't know if Will and Mike, you've seen this a lot or heard this a lot recently at Tel Aviv, with individuals that are coming new to Tel Aviv, not new Muslims. I'm talking about Muslims that have been Muslim their whole life. They're like, this is an amazing masjid. And I just like stopped in the middle of my track. like we're
they're calling not, Talif a masjid.
They're calling Talif a masjid more and more, and it's not coming from us. And in my mind, I'm like, okay, this reaffirms like my 5-year plan for Talif, where it's like Talif will continue to do what it does, inshallah, if Allah wants it to. But it would have a segment that's a masjid. Like it would have an actual area that's a masjid. And all you will do at that Talif masjid per se is pray. Like that's the whole function of the masjid there.
Well, the reason why this is happening is because, and I've said this multiple times, you cannot have, I don't believe we will ever get over the rooted psychology that says the mosque is the primary institution. And do we need alternative institutions? Absolutely. Islamic history proves that. The mosque, in fact, after the Prophet's time, was basically a place where you did Jum'ah. Some mosques operated as educational centers in addition to the Jum'ah and the daily prayers. And really a place of gathering. They built gardens around it, what have you. The Ottoman model is very interesting. Right. But really, like spiritual, intimate community, where did people find that? You went to the Zawiya, the Khanqa, right?
Which is I more identify Talif with, by the way, as more of a Zawiya.
Yeah, but see, in America, this is the challenge, right? People don't have a conception of what a Zawiya is. Mm-hmm. And then the people who've heard the term, Allah,
but they're all
say the word Zawiya?
Yeah, but they're all, I'm trying, honestly, when people ask me, what do you really think Talif is? I literally look at them, I'm like, Talif is more of a Zawiya than anything. Yeah. It's an intentional community, right? With intentional thoughts on what we're trying to do, right? It's if people travel, and when they travel, they find a space here, right? And then they go back on their way. Also, you could apply that to their spiritual journey too. Like, Talif is a great place to come to. It's not a place I necessarily want you to just stop at in your spiritual journey. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, this is why definitions become so important, because okay, what do we do? Do we start doing mass education, telling people there's this thing we call masjid, and there's also this thing we call zawiya? Or do we say, you know, like the definition of the third place, that you, or the you know, here's what a third place is. A masjid can be a third place, and then, you know, Talif, zawiya can be a third place. So without definitions, it's very normal for people to come into Talif and be like, oh, this is a really great masjid, because their only reference point to Muslim community.
Our masjid.
And I don't think that that's actually going to change anytime soon, which is why I'm so passionate about, hey, as we build these institutions, these alternative institutions that are central, we cannot forget about fixing the mosque. And so just as important as Talif is building alternative masjid institutions that can serve as models for other masajid and say, hey, they're doing it better than we are. Maybe we should reconsider, you know?
We saw during COVID, I called it like the programmatic boom of our generation, right? Like I think a lot of mosques were kind of like sleepy. Like the imam would do this class or they would have this class. But when COVID hit, I think everyone had an existential crisis of like, we don't have our space anymore. How are we engaging our attendees? Yeah. So everybody, I mean, even organizations around social justice, they all started these online programs and programming just boomed, right? And now that we're back in the mosques, at least in Chicagoland, I can't speak on the rest of the country. I think the trend is similar. But in Chicagoland, like every mosque now is, I mean, it almost looks like they're replicating each other, right? Like, right, copy, paste. But it's a good thing because they're trying to make sure that their institutions are packed with programming. And this might be that new wave of leadership coming in, now demanding we have these expectations. We want to see this place filled up.
But so can I comment on this?
Because
this is an amazing point. It's a very important point. You see what happens when we don't do the definition and the theory? People's expectations become the norm. And so, for example, is it a healthy direction for mosques to become buffets of mass programming, right?
That's exactly what I'm saying. If Talif had a masjid, it would just be a place for prayer.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, should a mosque be a place for prayer? Should a mosque have programming? Okay. if it has programming, what are priorities? One of the things that, because I know I can't give a system for governance that's going to appeal to everyone. And I, you know, I don't even think that's possible. So what I'm trying to do with the book is to say, are there like qawaid kulliya, like are there just universal principles, best practices that all mosques have to abide by? Priorities that, hey, you don't have to have a like 16 halaqas through the week because you think, oh, that's going to bring people. In fact, there is a burnout that comes from too much programming. But that level of intentionality.
We know.
I know too. Actually, I'm speaking from experience. I'm not speaking like anything I say is not like with a shaming tone at all. I'm speaking from experience. Like I thought when I was an imam at one point, I want to have a different program every day. And I did that. And then not a lot of people showed up. and you know, they would all show up to like our Friday the Kid and other programs. But they didn't show up to the daily programs. And I was just like, man, what's going on? These are really intentionally designed. They have cool names. You know, why aren't they coming? And it's because people are burnt out. Like they have home, they have work, they're already exhausted. Proximity is an issue. Post COVID, goodness sakes, no one's gonna drive. Who's gonna drive 45 minutes, 30 minutes, 20 minutes? You know, I live in small town Ohio for a reason. Because if I have to drive more than 5 minutes, it's a crisis. Yeah. So, yeah.
So, in terms of two questions, you brought up the whole thing about, hey, are mosques, the difficult question, are mosques ready to receive queer individuals? You also brought up another point of like how much programming should you expect from mosques? These are all questions I saw in your survey, right? From the survey that you've done. I wonder, in closing, as we kind of slide up out of here, is there like one thing that really stood out to you from the research? I know you're still analyzing it, but I'm curious to know, is there something like a finding that you have that just really stood out to you that yes. You'd be willing to share with us?
Yes, absolutely. So sense of community, you know, in the field is related to four elements. Membership, which is basically, it's about boundaries, because part of membership necessitates a conversation on what are the boundaries of that membership. You can't, even the Prophet ﷺ didn't just quote unquote include anyone in anything, right? There were certain, there's boundaries to that. It also talks about sense of belonging. All of that is just under membership. But for us, when we think sense of community, we only think of sense of belonging. In addition to membership, there's influence, which is how power is supposed to be shared, right? So that doesn't necessarily mean every structure has to be quasi-democracy. It just means that there's a transparency on how power is shared. Do people have influence in maybe not decision-making, but in the culture of the space? How do you give them that? So that's the second. The third is the idea of the fulfillment of needs. So what is the social economy that you're building? And is there a mutual exchange of resources within your community? Is there personal investment? This is something that comes up in the field, which I think is very important for Muslims, because we think, going back to the program example, we think just let people consume as much as possible and they're gonna have a strong sense of community. That's not actually what the field suggests. It says that personal investment is necessary for them to feel that. How does personal investment come in? Khidma. Like there has to be service, there has to be, you know, a personal stake in the community. And lastly, the idea of shared connection. This is where you have the shared symbols, programming activities, shared rituals that you do to make the space intentional. Now, that we called sense of community, and the main, you know, objective of the survey was to assess people's sense of community in Masajid. Now, one of the most important findings is that sense of community is inextricably linked to governance. In other words, people who report that they feel the mosque has poor governance or the management of the mosque is being administered poorly, that is inextricably linked to whether they feel that sense of community that we just discussed, which is incredibly significant because, you know, one of the things that I always grew up hearing, oh, if the people aren't at the mosque, That means they're leaving Islam, right? We all heard it. Let's just be real. We all heard it. We hear it at conferences. It's like this great problematization. And I'm sympathetic to it. We don't want people to leave Islam. We should be concerned if people aren't attending Muslim spaces. But what I'm learning from, you know, the recent findings, and alhamdulillah, we got close to 1,000 responses. This is a statistically significant survey, one of the largest ever, the only survey on sense of community, is that governance and sense of community are linked. So if you don't get your act together in terms of what your governance culture looks like, what your philosophy of leadership looks like, how this is supposed to be administered, well, guess what? People are not going to want to be a part of your space. And so when I mentioned like queer Muslim or that, for me, it's not just about centering this or that identity. It's more about we need to get serious about answering these questions because there's no easy answers. And the answer may be, hey, for certain segments of the community, there's a level of sense of community they're not going to find at the mosque. But you know what? They can find it at Tel Aviv. They can find it somewhere else, you know?
Absolutely.
It sounds like you're saying there needs to be a very concerted effort to be intentional. Whatever your model of community is going to be, there has to be a strong intention and follow through on that.
Absolutely. Intentional communities are traditionally defined as like eco-villages. But, you know, I think we have to reclaim the word because that's the heart of our tradition is niyyah. And say, no, intentionality can be in any community. And it just means figuring out what are the definitions, what are our principles and values, and what is our system for transparency in that, and how do we accomplish these goals and objectives through that ethos that we established and are transparent with people about.
That's great. I want to thank you a lot for coming today. I know you have a lot on your roster and you're traveling and teaching and building communities and all these phenomenal things. Alhamdulillah. I was surprised, honestly. I was not expecting this big point to be made. The relation. I mean, it's kind of like a duh, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's not also that the big connection between a sense of community is not necessarily like the charisma of the teacher or how present the staff is with you, but it's really like the culture of governance.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate you sharing that with us and giving us those insights. I look forward to seeing future conversations with you. Hopefully more people get you on to talk about what you've discovered and explore with them. We look forward to having you again here sometime soon. Just wanted to pass it to you, see if you wanted to make a plug, leave any information of how people can get to know more about the project you're working on.
Yeah, I mean, you can visit remos.com to take the survey. This will be just one of many surveys, inshallah, that we'll be releasing to tackle different dimensions. One of the things that we want to do is basically create a directory where people, not a directory, but like an open space on the website where people can go and be like, hey, this is a question that I think is central for the community. But really, the main thing that I want to say is loneliness is an epidemic. And, you know, mental illness is inextricably linked to people's rates of loneliness. And I think if Muslim communities aren't rising to this in a time of critical need in our country, then I don't think our priorities are straight. So, you know, that's what I hope to kind of tackle through this project. And inshallah, you can follow it on the website or on Instagram, Imam Deeb, or, you know, Talib's Instagram, apparently. You'll see
inshallah,
this podcast there.
Inshallah, follow us whenever you can. This was On Mosque to Remosque with Imam Ahmed Deeb and Dr. Will Caldwell, Mike Swice, and myself, Ali Dia. God bless you all. Ramadan Mubarak. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi.
You just listened to the Welcome Home podcast. Please consider becoming a monthly sustainer by joining 1000 Hearts of Talif and commit to giving $3 a day. Sign up today at talifcollective.org/donate. Thank you and peace.